Okay. Hello, this is Chiletta Dim, and I am here at Rahner Special Collections Library at Dartmouth College in Hanover, New Hampshire. It is May 26th, 2016, 1 p.m., and I'm here with Richard Detweiler, and he is... Rick, where are you?
Yeah, I'm here.
Where are you physically?
Oh, I am in Harrisburg, Vermont.
Harrisburg, Vermont. Wonderful. And we'll start our interview. So, Rick, just to start it off, when and where were you born?
Well, you're going way back, aren't you?
Yeah.
I was born in Rochester, New York, in October 1947.
Okay. And can you tell me a little bit about what it was like living in upstate New York at that time?
Yeah, my family moved around, so we lived Rochester, Binghamton, moved to Philadelphia for junior high days, and then back to Buffalo area, where I graduated from high school. So, you know, similar. It was kind of, from my experience, it was kind of a suburban life. You know, you get in the morning, go to school. That was a very traditional family. My father worked, my mother didn't. I have one older brother, 3 years older. We got along very well. And had a very normal teenagehood.
Hmm. So you said your family moved around a lot. Was there a particular reason?
Yeah, my father's job, he worked for Atlantic Refining, which turned into ARCO, a gas company. And he was in sales, then he was in real estate, and then he was in development for them. So he would move around from region to region every 4 or 5 years.
Mm. But it seems that it was all on the East Coast.
Yeah, exactly. Mm. Okay. We didn't do much traveling. Went to New Jersey to visit grandparents.
Mm.
As a family, I think that's as far north, south, east, or west as we got.
Oh, wow. Were you close with your grandparents in particular?
No. My father's parents had died before I was born. My mother's father died when I was about 10 or 12, and her mother then had Alzheimer's, and she lived with us a little bit, but it wasn't the typical grandmother, you know, and then she died when I was in college.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So you were born in 1945. World War II ended. At 47, I'm sorry. World War II ended in 1945. I was wondering, was your family involved in any way? Did you have anyone that served?
Yeah, my father was in the Navy. He was a Navy officer, as I became later. And he was on a minesweeper. Actually, he was sweeping the coast off of Normandy and D-Day.
Oh, wow.
And my wife's father was also in the Navy. He was a radioman on the Enterprise, and he was in... Early on, actually, the Enterprise was pulling into Pearl Harbor on December 7th, and they deflected. They told them to stay out, so they stayed out, and they got away from that. But he went through the whole Pacific campaign. He saw a lot of action there. Mm-hmm. And both my mother's brothers were doctors in the Navy. Grandparents, no, but certainly the greatest generation, you know, the World War II group, family was very, glad so many Americans were, right?
Mm. So did your father or family members talk a lot about their experience in World War II as you were growing up?
No, they didn't talk a lot about it, but they didn't avoid it either. Occasionally my father would bring it up, or I would bring it up, or ask a question or something like that, but it wasn't a topic on the table by the time I was a conscious little toddler. and he was then only, you know, he didn't stay in the reserves. He wasn't in for a career. I think he went in about 41 or 42. And my brother was born in 44, so he was still around in late 43. But then, again, he was a skipper of a minesweeper, so they went overseas. And then he got out right at the end of the war.
Could you tell me your parents' names, quickly?
Yeah, my mother was Muriel Detweiler. My father was Charles Detweiler.
Well, do you know your mother's maiden name?
F-O-U-L-K, Folk.
Okay, thank you. So, moving around a lot, where did you go to high school?
I started high school outside of Philadelphia in Berwyn, Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. And in beginning of 11th grade, we moved to Hamburg, New York, where I graduated from high school.
Mm-hmm. What was that like, moving around so much, especially at such a pivotal age?
Yeah, well, we didn't move every year. It was a five-year, pretty much, interval. Okay. We were 5 years in Buffalo, you know, those 2 years in high school, and then another couple years in college or so. 5 years in Philly, 5 years in Binghamton before that. Before that, I wasn't very conscious. So, you know, I made friends. I kept friends somewhat. I think it developed some flexibility in me. I mean, as an adult, I've moved around a lot, too. And I think it also developed some skills in terms of social skills as well as coping skills. And it was not terrible. It did not bother me. Nor really anybody in the family. You kind of did what the dad's job said you were going to do.
And what was your older brother's name?
Chip.
Chip. And he was 3 years older.
Huh?
So, and he was 3 years older?
Yes.
Correct. Yes. Okay. What were you like as a student? How was school like?
I did okay in school. Hence going to Dartmouth. I think I did my work fast. I stayed up with it. It wasn't like I had to twist my arm. But I was in sports and clubs, and I had my friends, and we would screw around. So I wasn't just a wonk. But I did fine. And graduated. Even after changing high school. In Hamburg, coming in there with a very different record, I think it was up in the top 10 of my class, that kind of thing. School was never a drag to me. It was a source of friends, source of activities, and I don't have the memories of adolescence that we're supposed to of trauma and despair.
So you said you did sports and clubs. What sort of sports and activities were you doing at school?
As I was waiting for you, I was looking at my email, and Coach Riley just sent out a thing that he's got matching gifts for $50,000 for the soccer team. I go, oh, my God. How did he get that? Because I played soccer at Dartmouth all 4 years. Actually sat on the bench all 4 years, but I was physically on the team. I played soccer in high school, that was the one thing I did regularly and had some ability to play. I'd go out, one of my buddies and I went out ran track one spring, we joined the volleyball team 1 year, I wrestled 1 year, soccer was pretty much the one thing I could claim that I participated in.
And were you recruited for soccer at Dartmouth, or was it just something you decided to continue?
Okay. No, a long way from that. I showed up. I did come early freshman year for practice, but I was a walk-on.
Okay.
I think I got 10 minutes of Ivy League time my senior year. I think that was my total. He put me in when we played Castleton, or KUA, but then...
Did your parents go to college?
Yeah, they both went to Penn.
Mm-hmm. University of Pennsylvania or Penn State?
Well, both graduated from the University of Pennsylvania. My father started at Penn State.
Okay.
And then he had to drop out. He ran out of money, and he worked for a year or two and then worked himself. And then he was living in Philly, so he went to Penn then and worked himself through the rest of college.
So what... how did you decide on Dartmouth?
I got a ROTC scholarship. And I think that's why I got into Dartmouth, because they had 25 slots, and I was one of them that had put Dartmouth on its list. I you know, we went around with my parents. We did the tour. I might have gone to Dickinson. My brother was there, but I wanted to break away from him. You know, I wanted to go my own route. And I really liked Hanover. I mean, I just, coming in there, I liked the small town. I liked the outdoors. I liked the feel of it. You know, the ROTC thing was a great opportunity, and, you know, I paid for college. I had known a couple people from high school who were at Dartmouth, and I liked them. They liked the school. So it just had all the pieces that I was looking for.
You said you got a Rossi scholarship, is that correct?
ROTC, yes.
Oh, okay, ROTC scholarship, okay.
Yeah.
So you were thinking about joining the military even before starting school?
Well, yes. I mean, you know, consider the time, which is the subject of what we're talking about here.
Mm-hmm.
And there were student deferments still.
Mm-hmm.
And I was probably going to go in, but I wanted to go as an officer.
Okay.
And which meant you had to get the college degree first, you know, typically, especially as a naval officer. And I wanted to go in the Navy if I had to go. You know, I felt a little bit of patriotism in terms of that's what you do. My father, you know, had done that. And so the ROTC scholarship seemed like a good way of approaching that. You graduate with your commission. You don't have to go to the Naval Academy. And, you know, you got to give 4 years at the end, but that was worth the bargain, I thought. So it wasn't like I wanted to go in the Navy and then, okay, I got to stall for 4 years while I get my degree and commission. It was just kind of the whole package.
So can you say a little bit about your first term at Dartmouth, your first fall, and what year was that?
Yeah, it'll be fall of 65.
Okay.
I was very young, immature, short, and my eyes were wide open. Some of the particular memories I had was the variety of kids that were there. My roommate was from a recruited football player from South Dakota who lasted a year. All these preppies, I mean, the school was full of these kids from prep school experience, which was totally different from mine.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, then I don't know what it is now, but you didn't rush a fraternity till sophomore year, so freshman you were kind of dorm bound. I had some friends, one friend I'd gone to high school and outside of Philadelphia with. I hadn't seen him in 2 years, and he shows up at Dartmouth. So I built some friends. I found the academics extremely challenging, much more so than high school. It didn't come easy anymore. So I had to work, but I also socialized. And you know, thoroughly enjoyed it.
So what sort of activities were you doing at Dartmouth? So you did soccer, and you were in ROTC. Were those your main activities?
Well, ROTC was not a terrible time commitment. It was Wednesday afternoon for a couple hours. You had to go drill. And other than that, you took a course, which meant once or twice a week. I think it's a lot heavier now, although I don't think Dartmouth has Navy ROTC. I think they have Army or something. I think up to Norwich, I don't know. But that was not a terrible load. I played soccer, was on the lacrosse team for a few weeks until my English professor gave me a D and said I wasn't doing so going to pass. So I dropped out of that. And I worked on the newspaper freshman year, you know, did the all-nighters and helping with some articles and so forth. Outing club, you know, the ski and stuff that they teach you how to ski, those kinds of things. But mainly, you know, the course load was a full load. Didn't have a car, of course, so, you know, social life was limited. And as a freshman, you just worm dirt, as you know, so that part was limited. And, you know, social life was really focused around fraternities in those days. So if you weren't in one, that was you know, you had to kind of find your way.
Mm-hmm. Did you join a fraternity?
Yeah, I did. SIU is still there.
What were your experiences in it?
You know, my closest friends, who we get together every year for the summer. I lived overseas for 21 years, and we come back in the summer, though, and we're fraternity brothers. There are four of us that are very tight, you know, godfathers of kids, and we still see each other and so forth. So I think that is kind of represents what I feel about the fraternity life there, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Good friends. Everybody was not the same. We had a real variety of folks in SIU in those days.
Mm-hmm.
But there was an opportunity to, you know, forge some really strong friendships.
Do you remember those men's names?
Those what?
Do you remember the names of those friends that you were very close to? Do you remember their names?
Yeah, the three that are John Roll, Ed Damon, and Rick Lounsbury.
Can you spell his last name?
Lounsbury is Lounsbury.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, so as you're in ROTC at Dartmouth in this time, Vietnam is amping up. Was there any major discussion on campus that you were tuned into?
Oh, yeah, big time, right? I mean, the big protest, Occupy Parkhurst, that was all that spring.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, throughout, especially around elections, you know. I mean
mm-hmm.
I voted for McCarthy and McGovern and those guys. I didn't vote for Nixon. I didn't want to go to Vietnam. I thought it was terrible mm-hmm. to be there. Not enough that I was going to, you know, give up my commission or break the law. You know, kind of almost a moralist in that you make a commitment and you follow through with it. So, yeah, there was lots of discussion then. It picked up after Kent State, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
A lot. So mm-hmm. it was minor, but there weren't being an ROTC was very interesting, was, in my experience, no way a marker of who I was or how I interacted with friends, you know. My roommate in the house was in all the protests. I think he was in part. I mean, so that was not viewed as, you know, your statement of who you are. It was, okay, some people signed up, some people didn't, all right. But yes, there were lots of discussions. I can't recall the texture of them other than, you know, what you know about from having studied that period.
Mm-hmm. Do you have your roommate's name?
Yeah, Pete Bryant.
Bryant. Can you spell the last name?
Bryant.
Okay, thank you.
I haven't seen or heard of him since June of 1969. So,
okay. Maybe we can get in contact with him.
Yeah, there were three of us that lived together in the house. He was a year behind us, but he was in there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so graduating, you would have graduated in 69, and were there any particular core memories or major takeaways you took from your time at Dartmouth that may have helped you as you're entering your commission?
Well, I remain a strong supporter of ROTC because I think the notion of citizen soldier, particularly in the officer and the senior cadre, is really important. And I just found that having a liberal arts education, you know, having been in an academic environment of the caliber of Dartmouth, gave me a perspective and maybe some ability to think through what I was perceiving and seeing in terms of recognizing the big picture, looking at some of the ethical issues underlying some of the things we did. And I just think that Now, you know, I mean, I was living that life at the time, so I don't think I was consciously saying, oh, I am a liberal arts educated officer. I can think differently. But just reflecting back upon your question, I think that was probably the most important preparation, if you will, that I could have. You know, a lot, during my time in the Navy, I associated with a lot of folks from the academy. Geez, they had a totally different worldview, you know? And I was just so grateful for the both the academic background, but also the social milieu, and more importantly, the variety of people at Dartmouth and the variety of perspectives.
Yeah, so can you talk a little bit about your senior year and what graduating was like?
Well, yeah, a little bit. I finally got my act together with my courses, so I started getting decent grades again. I was not a terribly good student. I was in. I graduated in the top three quarters of my class. That's
what
I said. That's nothing to brag about. No, but I was getting it together academically. I was taking some neat courses, you know, because I was a biology major, and you know, all the introductory stuff of the first 2-3 years was over. And I was pre-med too, so I had to, you know, grind through physics, organic chemistry, all that stuff. All that was done by the time I was a senior, and I was able to take art history, and then biology classes were very focused, you know, and endocrinology and flowering plant taxonomy, which were really, it was a lot more fun to do that kind of stuff. So academically, it was more interesting. By then, I had a car, I had a social life, and, you know your way around when you're a senior, you got a bank of friends. I guess one thing that was maybe a little different was, all my buddies were kind of wondering what they were going to do next, because the draft was there, the lottery system had not been implemented yet, and when they graduated, it was up to their local draft board what was going to happen to them. So, guys were scurrying around trying to get in the guard or trying to get a deferment to go teach somewhere, go in the Peace Corps, looking at, you know, embellishing their twisted ankle or whatever. They were engulfed in that. Whereas for me, it was a non-issue. I knew what I was doing. Mm-hmm. So it was not a worry. I was not dreading it. It was just what was next. And it cleared the plate a lot for being able to, you know, focus on what I was doing.
Yes.
Being a student, you know, and being in Dartmouth for my last semester and quarter, rather, and, saying goodbye to buddies, that kind of stuff.
Were there any professors or coaches that you were particularly close to?
Certainly not anymore, but at that point, you know, you probably heard of Whitey Burnham. There's a Burnham Field. He was a soccer coach.
Oh, yes.
And I actually wrote to him about 10 years ago, eight or 10 years ago. I was working in Brazil. And I wrote to him out of the blue. And he wrote back to me, and it was a wonderful recollection. He died, like, literally a few months later, I think. But, But, he was a kind of a character, he claimed he remembered me, but I don't think so, because I would give the hat to the player. But it was, even though I was not the starting, you know, he treated me with respect, and I remember that. There was a professor named Slesnik who was in the math department forever. And I remember I took math, freshman year, and we used to have these fraternity cocktail parties, faculty tales parties on a Friday night or something, I don't know. And he would always get invited by somebody. And he always always remembered me thereafter, every year, even as a senior, even though I wasn't a math major or anything. So those kinds of things matter, don't they? Little offshoots. I remember the guy that taught art history. How fascinating! I mean, that course was like you went on a tour every class. times a week. It was just great. I could probably dig up some others if I thought about it more, but certainly I did not maintain contact with any professors. You know, I was in the Navy for 4 years and then moving on from there.
Okay, so you graduate in 69. What comes next?
What comes next is I go to New York to my roommate's wedding.
Okay.
I fly from there to California and get on a destroyer as a brand new ensign with a division of 20 men that I was responsible for. And in September, we headed for Vietnam.
Mm-hmm. So you road tripped from New York to California?
Yeah.
Yeah. And knowing what you're about to embark on, do you remember what you were feeling at that time? How long was this trip? Were you alone?
I was alone. I just bombed out there. You know, 12 hours a day, probably three, four days. And no, I was excited. I was glad I was moving on. I had to, you know, doing something. Mm. You know, I knew where I was going. I was on a destroyer. It wasn't like, oh, God, am I going to get shot or anything? And a little nervous about taking on the responsibility of suddenly having, you know, some enlisted guys that you're responsible for. Because, well, you know it. I don't, unless you're involved in some other things. As a college student, you're responsible for only one person.
Right.
And then suddenly, you know, 21 years old, you got this other system. I mean, you know, there's a system that supports you. But I certainly didn't dread it. I think I was looking forward to the next step. I tend to see things positively. I don't think I was thinking, oh, I wish I was traveling Europe with my buddies. I was ready to go.
Right. So how was training like?
Well, you know, we had all our training during ROTC, so that two trimesters out of the year, everything from leadership to naval operations to naval engineering. We had to take a military history course, you know, so that was the academic stuff. And then your drills, which were a joke. You'd put on the uniform and go and stand there, and maybe you'd march around, but nobody took it seriously. And then in the summers, we went 6 weeks each summer, which was, I found, just fascinating. The first year, we went to Puerto Rico. I was on a cruiser out of Charleston, South Carolina. I went to Puerto Rico, and I'd never been out of the Northeast. So then the second summer, we spent 3 weeks in Virginia with the Marines, trying to recruit us to join the Marine option, and 3 weeks in Corpus Christi with the aviation group, trying to they wanted us to choose those branches, you know, and you know, I got to fly a plane, got to do touch and goes. I mean, I was doing all this stuff that, you know, my buddies weren't doing. It was very interesting. And then the last summer, which was the real training, I guess, that was really germane to what was coming down the pike, which was we were on a ship, and I was on a ship out of Brooklyn. It wasn't so great, but and we were like junior officers, and we were under training here, if you will, and we had to, you know, take on some responsibilities for those 6 weeks. So the training was kind of spread out over the 4 years. Of course, once you arrive, you know, you have the chain of command and people to guide you when I was on the ship. But the training itself, it was kind of over, and you're diving in.
So you, about when do you arrive at your destination?
Okay, I arrived in California, Long Beach, California, late June, about, you know, 10 days after graduation.
Oh, wow. Very quick.
Aboard a ship, and you live on the ship, so it's there. You're there.
So what were your first couple weeks like on the ship?
It was like Fraternity Rush. You were going around trying to meet people, trying to remember people, trying to find your way around, or maybe like freshman week, right? It was, you know, the ship is a finite ship. The destroyer, you know, is not a tiny ship, but it's got a lot of nooks and crannies. And trying to find your way around and not look like a fool. which everybody knows you are because you're an ensign with the shiniest bars ever. and just trying not to screw up and not to be a dope and learn as fast as I could what was going on.
So what was your chain of command like? What were your peers like? Who were you in charge of? Who was supervising you?
Yeah, so there were like about 300 people on the ship, about 20 mm-hmm. officers. Mm-hmm. And there were, you know, two or three of us brand new, another three or four who'd been around for a year or so, and then it kind of pyramided up to the commanding officer who, you know, what he was the rank of commander. He's probably about 35. And, you know, he'd been in the Navy for 15, 18 years, and then the next in line was the next rank down, a little bit further down, and then there was the senior management, we called them the department heads, who'd been in the Navy 3-4 years, and they were really the ones that you worked for. You know, there were mm-hmm. two or three of us very junior people to each one of those department heads, if you will, and they were kind of the guides. And,
do you remember any of their names, the name of your commanding officer, for example?
Tom Meeks.
Meeks, okay. Were you close
with... He was a Naval Academy guy, and just a tight ass, and arrow thinking, and he represented what I spoke of earlier.
How is it like living under that sort of leadership?
Well, it's fine because I mean, you know, you bitch about it with everybody else, but it wasn't the Kane Mutiny again. You know, he wasn't terrible, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. you know, in the military, there is a deep and broad bank of regulations and mm-hmm. protocols that one follows. So, you know, it's not like you're. Internship at Google where anything goes out there.
So you were talking about how there were a few officers of your age group and how you all sort of had these sort of feelings about the regimentation of the military. Were you guys close? I mean, you're all living on this one ship, but what was that social dynamic like?
Yeah, you know, you do get pretty close on the ship. I mean, you're out to sea. One time we were out to sea for 54 days, I remember.
Great. Oh, wow.
Without getting off the ship. So, you know, mm-hmm. and then when we were off the coast of Vietnam, you were on watch 6 hours on, 6 hours off, and then you had a work day on top of that. So you weren't getting a lot of sleep. You're in each other's face all the time. Mm-hmm. So you really do build a camaraderie and a team. You know, everybody's tired, everybody's pulling together to make some things work.
Right.
And then you'd hit port, and you'd go out and, you know, blow it off with a couple buddies.
Mm.
And hit the bars and jump around. So, yeah, there were some good friendships. None that endure today, but
okay.
At the time, they were very important.
And you were talking about how... a lot of them are academy men. Can you talk a little bit about what that experience is like, interacting with people from a very different military background experience from yourself?
Yeah, some of them were. Not you know, probably 30%, something like that. I don't know.
Okay.
More of the senior people, the people who stayed in, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I alluded to that earlier. I don't want to paint the broad brush for everybody, but...
Of course.
Typically... a little more gung-ho, a little more narrow-minded, I might say. You know, with exceptions, clearly. But mm-hmm. I think that kind of characterizes it.
Can you explain your day-to-day? What were you doing on a regular basis on the ship?
Okay, well, I was on the ship for a year and a half, so I did three different mm-hmm. jobs in the Navy. But mm-hmm. for that part, yeah, you'd wake up early in the morning, and you'd all come together with your work group, you know, the people that I was responsible for, mm-hmm. and you'd figure out the work plan for the day. I was in a repair division, it was called. So we were the guys that, the people that worked for me were all mechanics and machinists and engine men, and they would be working on trying to keep the ship running. And you had different tasks going on. And then if you're underway, you've got on top of those daily tasks, you've got other things that come up. You know, and again, when we were off the coast of Vietnam, every 3 days we would take on ammunition, and every 2 days we'd take on fuel, and every couple days we'd take on more supplies, food and stuff. So there's always some kind of evolution going on. Or a helicopter would come, or we'd have to go and shoot off and do some transfer of personnel across the ship. So there's always something on top of that. So no day was exactly the same. But basically, it's this overlay of these special evolutions, if you will, on top of your normal daily routine. And as an officer, you know, I wasn't supervising the actual guys with their wrenches and so forth, but more working through the senior enlisted guys who did that. And just trying to prioritize and work the whole thing into our shift schedule. But again, no day exact alike like another one.
Okay. Yeah. So can you talk a little bit about these three stages in your year and a half in Vietnam? Were they spread out evenly?
The three stages are my four years. So the first year and a half, I was on the destroyer. I told you I was an officer. Mm-hmm. And then the next 12 months, I was an advisor in country. Mm-hmm. I was a naval advisor in Vietnam. And then my last year and a half, I was a race relations instructor out of Newport, Rhode Island. Mm-hmm. They were three very different jobs, which kept it... I guess that fits with my... moving around as a kid, right? I was ready.
Yeah, for sure.
In fact, I wanted that. I could have stayed on the destroyer longer, but and they said, well, you're probably going to go to Vietnam. I said, okay, so be it. And I did. And then I could have stayed longer in Vietnam, but I didn't want to do that. And I could have stayed in the Navy, but I didn't want to do that either.
So going back to the destroyer, you're living in a very confined space with a lot of people, but the same people. And was sending letters easy? Were you able to contact with family regularly?
Yeah, you won't believe it. Someone your age, what it was like. Yeah, anagrams, right? These old letters that you would fold up and seal and mail them off. That was it. Yeah, we were able. We had mail when you're deployed. You know, every time you take on some fuel or something, there's a mail bag that goes over and comes back. So you'd get mail once a week. You know, you'd send it once a week. I mean, it took 2 weeks to get anywhere, but there was that process. But, yeah, certainly no email and no phone or that kind of thing. But, you know, that's what it was, so you didn't know any better.
Was there... Can you describe the sort of letters you were sending? Was it mainly to family? Did you have a girlfriend? Was it friends?
Yes and no. Mainly to family. Maybe mainly parents. They're the only ones that write back. Yeah, I did have a girlfriend for the first few months I was as an advisor when I was in country, until I got a letter from her saying that she'd gotten married. So that kind of dulled that relationship.
Right.
Classic.
As it does.
Classic, yeah. Exchanging, you know, with somebody, these guys I told you about, especially the one friend who had gone in the Army and had spent a year in Vietnam in combat. He just missed. He left, literally, he left country the day I arrived.
Wow.
Do you remember
his name?
John Roll.
Okay. And he's in the same class year as yourself?
No, he was 67.
Okay. Yeah. So how often were you on the on the coast of Vietnam?
When we were on the destroyer?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. When I was on the ship, we were... Or do you mean on land? What do you mean?
Yeah, on land. Did you... like disembark?
Yeah. No, or when I was on the destroyer for a year and a half, I didn't touch the soil. Okay? You're on the ship. We'd be off the coast, a mile off the coast, both South Vietnam, a mile off, way up in North Vietnam, and we'd be shooting our guns and into positions, or we'd be out at sea, following an aircraft carrier or something like that, but never went. Mm-hmm. But then in January of 1971, I arrived in Saigon, and I had boots on the ground then for 12 months, so I was right in Vietnam.
Okay. How did that transition work? Did you ask for a change, or was it an opportunity given to you?
No, it was after a year and a half, you could retour on your ship if you wanted to, but I was tired of that stuff. So I communicated to the people in Washington. They had a process to get what your interests were. And I did not particularly want to be in combat. So I said, but I knew that by then, I think out of six officers who had left the ship, five of them had gone in country. So I knew that was coming. And they came back. I remember getting a call when I was still on the ship. They said, from the man assigned to my part of the alphabet or whatever, said, well, I got something for you. Since you were a biology major, you must know about agriculture and animal husbandry and stuff. So I got a position. We need a fishing and agriculture advisor to the Vietnamese Navy. And I said, okay, I'll do it. So it wasn't like I could turn it down. That became the marker. And then the transition was trying to get ready for that. And, there's some training I had to go through and before you go to get, weapons training and survival training and that kind of stuff. And then I was on a plane to Vietnam.
And when was that? What month?
January of 71.
Okay. Yeah, so where did you land? What was where did you land?
I landed in Saigon. I worked out of an office in Saigon, a Navy headquarters, because that's where our counterparts were. I had a lieutenant in the Vietnamese Navy, who was my counterpart, who was assigned to this fishing and agriculture program, too, and I was there to work with him. Basically, what we supplied was the material, and I had 10 to 12 guys working for me who actually knew about growing stuff and fishing.
Right.
And we would be, and we were also really trying to promote the program. It was like a civic action program, very different from the typical Vietnam experience, which is one reason I was interested in talking with you, because I think my experience was so different than the typical Vietnam death experience that I think that there's a message there that we can learn from. So I had an office in Saigon, but I was out of Saigon about 50% of the time. So I traveled from the very far north, right at the DMZ, there was a Navy base, all the way down to an island off the southern coast. So there were about 50 Vietnamese Navy bases, and I probably went to half of them or two-thirds of them.
Oh, wow.
12 months.
So you're talking about, you mentioned how this experience is very different from what a lot of soldiers who were sent to Vietnam was like. Was there a particular reason?
Yeah, several. Number one, I never got shot at. That was huge. Number two, I was like an independent operator. I really had a lot of control over what I did. It was a project, and there was a hierarchy there. There was a senior officer in charge, but he didn't have a clue what I was doing. So I was able to do my own planning schedule, plan the schedule for the men that worked for me, and really develop this program from nothing into something. I think it was a constructive experience rather than a destructive experience, if you will. Mm-hmm. What we did was we started agriculture projects and fishing projects at the Vietnamese Navy bases. It sounds weird, I know, but the idea was, at that point, we were trying to turn over a lot of the operations to the Vietnamese, and in turning it over, they would not engage in whatever the mission was, because they were more, you know, sailors, they were more concerned about their family. When they went off to on a patrol, their family didn't eat. There was no... So the notion was that if we started some self-help programs, and you know, they could do that. They could have a self-help fishing program at every Navy base because they had the ships, and we could give them the equipment. They could have, you know, victory gardens, truck gardens on every base. So if we could get them to be more self-sufficient, the families, then maybe the sailors wouldn't go and hide up, go fishing instead of going up to engage the enemy. So, so there was a method to the madness of what we were doing, and it made a lot of sense to me. So I felt that it was really contributing something to that group.
So I'm sure you're working a lot with local Vietnamese people. What was that like?
Yeah. Yeah, Vietnamese Native people, yeah. Mm-hmm. Wonderful people. I'm sure, I mean, it's the hottest tourist place now, right?
Right.
We went back, our family went back about 10 years ago. 15 years ago we went for, it was 2000, we went on vacation and had that same thing. They have a, I mean, the Vietnamese culture is a, what I recall, and is a very... thoughtful, you know, this whole Confucianism is big there. They're, you know, they've been through hell, but they were still seeing the positive of things. They were, I found the ones I worked with, honest, hardworking. The relationship with the Vietnamese was always very positive from my perspective.
Were they... particularly receptive to this program?
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, so, they were, you know, they had, individuals had different perspectives, but in general, yes, they were.
So could you explain the day-to-day in this job? Was it mostly planning, or?
Well, yeah, half the time I was in Saigon, you know, I was acquiring materials, fish nets, you know, going out to different suppliers in the city, or with my some of my fishing guides, you know, agricultural stuff. I was arranging for stuff to be shipped in. I was doing reports, you know, how many pounds of fish were caught and what the caloric intake was, and then I was planning the next trip and writing up reports for the previous trip. And then the half the time I was out, I mean, it took you a while to get anywhere because I was traveling. I had blanket travel orders. I could go anywhere in Vietnam anytime. It was wonderful. So I'd go out to the airport, and I'd hop on a plane that was going to an air base up north, and there I'd get on a helicopter that was going to the coast, and there I'd get on a riverboat that was heading up to the base I was going to. It was that kind of thing. Usually when I took off, I didn't know how I was going to get to where I was going to get, but they knew I was coming in the next few days. So I'd get to a base, and then I'd meet with... The Navy advisors who were stationed at that base, and then together we would meet with the Vietnamese commanders who were at the bases, you know, describing to them the program, explaining the protocols, and, you know, just trying to set up some systems so that they would adopt it. But half the time I traveled with my counterpart, the Vietnamese lieutenant, but he didn't like to leave Saigon much, so he didn't...
Do you remember his name?
Dai Huy Lim.
Do you know how it's spelled?
Dai Huy is lieutenant. I think, or was it Kim? I don't remember. Probably Lim, L-I-M. And then I had he was relieved by an ensign whose name was, I think, L-I-E-N. I'm not sure. Long time.
Who else were you interacting with in Vietnam apart from your Navy counterparts?
Well, the other officers, there were three or four of us. I was doing fishing and agriculture. There was a guy who was doing pigs and chickens, literally.
Mm.
There was a guy who was doing dependent housing.
Mm.
And there was a guy doing veterans affairs. So basically it was the four of us for the program. And so we were pretty tight, particularly a couple of the guys.
Oh, nice. And how long were you in this position?
A year.
A year.
I mean, one of the guys I'm still friends with. I'm godfather to his son. I introduced him to the woman he married. And,
you know, oh, wow.
And that was, 40 years ago, right? So that's a long time ago.
Yeah. Do you remember his name?
Yeah, his name is John King. K-A-N-E. Now, he's an Academy guy, but he was different.
Yeah. Were there any major takeaways or memories from this time that you want to speak about?
Oh, yeah. A big piece that affected me was just the notion of living in a different culture.
Mm.
I really thrived on that. And, you know, I came back and I got married. You know, my wife, I got married. We immediately went in the Peace Corps about 2 years in Botswana. And then we came back here for 10 years, and then we went overseas again and spent 21 years overseas. And that, I think, was all seeded by my year in Vietnam. It wasn't from graduating from school in Buffalo, New York, for sure.
Right.
So that notion of the world is a big place. So, and even now, I'm still doing consulting work. So, I mean, I just got back from India on Monday. And, that travel thing of living in the country and getting to know it was sparked by that time. The other piece was, and this gets a little, perhaps it sounds trite, but it certainly is an impact on me, is, and what's brought it out, of course, is all our military incursions since then, Iraq and Afghanistan being the most egregious, but how it just doesn't work. I mean, it was evident to me in traveling around a lot. I got to see a lot of different situations, and although I was never in combat, right, but I got to see, and it just doesn't work. You can't go in and fight a guerrilla war, the kind of thing we're doing now, and expect to win. You're talking heart, you know, you got to get the hearts and minds, and I felt what I was doing was working in that direction. But, and then you see what we did in Iraq and what we did in Afghanistan. My wife and I often say if we sent 100,000 Peace Corps volunteers as a surge instead of infantrymen, I just never would have had a chance. So that was a strong lesson to me.
Mm.
The former one about living in another culture really had direct impact on my life. And the latter one was a more esoteric or political perspective maker, if you will.
So you were in this position for a year, and then you made a transition to becoming a race relations specialist. Can you explain how that transition worked?
Yeah, you've never heard a career like this. Nobody has.
It's very new to me and quite interesting.
The same guy, the top of the Navy, a guy named Zumwalt, who was the head of the Navy, the CNO, who was, when he was in Vietnam, and he was in charge of the Navy in Vietnam, he started this program, this fishing and agriculture thing, the whole program. When he left there, and he went back and he was promoted, he was the head of the whole Navy. At that time, the Navy, the whole country was embedded in, embroiled in racial strife. And it reached the Navy. And there were protests. There was a riot on an aircraft carrier, a big deal.
Wow.
And they said, that's enough. We got to do something about it. So what they did is they created an office of race relations. And I got in on the ground floor of it. And what they wanted was they had a center in the West Coast and a center in the East Coast. And in each center, they set up teams. And they trained us in race relations instruction particular program. And then I was in Newport with about 8 other people. And what there were, I was the token white officer. And there was a black officer, and there was a white enlisted, and a black enlisted guy. And we would go out in teams, and there were 3 or 4 of them, I guess. And we would go out in teams, a white guy and a black guy, and an officer and enlisted. And we would conduct seminars that were 2.5 days long to groups of Navy people. We might go to a ship and do it with a select group of 15, 20 people in the ship. The idea is you're seeding some of these ideas. I was then involved in training. They trained the entire flag officer corps, all the admirals in the Navy, 200-300 of them.
Wow.
So I did a trip to Europe where we went to Greece, we went to Italy, and we ran training with a bunch of these senior guys. Oh, that was a piece of work. These guys aren't used to some lieutenant instructing them, if you will. So I did that for 1.5 years out of Newport, Rhode Island, conducting those seminars and traveling with it.
How long were you in this position?
1.5 years.
1.5 years, starting from 71, or?
Yeah, I came back from Vietnam at the end of 71, so from 72 until I got out of the Navy in June of 73.
What was the training for something like that like? What were you learning in those initial weeks?
They sent me to a 7-week institute called the Defense Race Relations Institute, located in Cocoa Beach, Florida, on an Air Force base down there, where they were people from all branches of the military, and it was basically a 7-week crash course in race relations / adult learning / instructing, with the background that one would need for that. There was a curriculum, but we were able to give input to it, which was then a package which we presented. And it consisted of basically a seminar format. I mean, the training was at that as well. Seminar format with prompts, videos, readings, activities. You know, you do the activity where you designate some people as the have-nots and other people as the haves, and you go through that simulation, those kinds of things. And then there were some field trips we went down to Miami and, to wherever the wrong side of the tracks was. We did the Meals on Wheels thing for an afternoon, I think. I don't know. But it was the design of the program was to prepare people to return to their branch of service and to their post and, be able to conduct actual training in really an attitude adjustment.
Do you think the trainings that you were giving, that they were received well?
Oh, it was all across the world, Gilletta. You can imagine. People were no different then than they are now. And, I mean, there were people who would have followed Trump back then. They're around. So, some people, it was like, it was totally swimming upstream. And they were ornery and resistant. Other people were right on board, right on, this is right. Glad to hear it, get some official. And a lot of people were in the middle saying, oh, I never thought of it that way. Oh, I never thought of their perspective. Oh, so, it was the whole range of things. It was very challenging and rewarding. Not everyone worked, right?
What do you think you learned in this very interesting period of your life?
Yeah, that 1.5 years, you mean?
Yeah, as a race relations specialist.
Well, on a plus side, I learned a lot about my own perspective on race, even growing up in an integrated environment, particularly when I lived in Philly, good friends who were all kinds of shades of the rainbow. But I realized how institutional forces, do have an impact on individuals. So it was a good self-reflection time. I learned a lot of skills, I think, in terms of working with adults as learners. I think I learned some human relations things, how to listen, how to speak in a way that will be heard. Also learned I didn't, pretty much decided I didn't want to stay in the Navy. It was way too regimented.
I would imagine that this sort of position would be especially interesting after, the 60s had just passed and there was a lot of the civil rights movement was going on at that time. And how was the interactions with the black soldiers that you were working on this project with?
Well, you're right. The timing was fascinating because that was the time, the civil rights movement, all right, it was law. But that didn't mean nothing in some places, right? And so what was happening was there was a big backlash coming. So particularly blacks, much more so than now. We talk about the entire spectrum of minorities, but it was really a black-white issue. In fact, I still remember one of the. Of all people, Cosby did a video called Black, White, Uptight, which we use as a prompt. We could have used his stuff for something else. That was a long time ago. But it was really an uptight time. There were protests in terms of, some really fundamental and profoundly important things, as well as how long you can wear your hair, and how big a fro a black enlisted guy could wear, and whether he could wear the comb in his head. I mean, so it was all across the board. And then you had these rednecks who were would come out and with these outrageous statements, but you'd see them afterwards with a black guy who was their best friend, And then you'd have, some brighter folks who could spiel off all the progressive liberal kind of mentality, but they drop something later on that would tell you that it was all superficial, So very complex. And as you say, that time, race relations was very high on the agenda. You could just tune in Walter Cronkite and there'd be something about it. So I think it was another opportunity for me to be involved in something that mattered.
And you're doing this all out of Rhode Island?
We lived in Rhode Island. There's a big Navy base in Newport, and that's where we were stationed.
And so when do you finish this this part of your service? What year?
June of 73. My 4-year obligation was over. And I got out of the Navy.
And what did you do immediately after that?
I went to graduate school. I went to BU. I was going to go to medical school. So I was taking the rest of the pre-med school courses. I was trying to pass organic chemistry, which I'd gotten a D at Dartmouth. And after the first semester, I had a break, and I did some substitute teaching. My wife was a teacher. We were living in Boston. And the substitute teaching really appealed. My brother was a doctor, and he was not happy with his life, and he was working his tail off. And I said, I don't want to do this for another 5 years. So I shifted programs to get a master's in education and started teaching outside of Boston a year after I got out of the Navy.
And what were you teaching? Biology?
Yeah, I was teaching high school science. I went into Peace Corps for 2 years and taught in Botswana.
Okay.
Science in a local school, local high school.
What year was that?
That was 75 to 77.
In Botswana?
Yeah.
What was that experience like? What was the calculus into going into the Peace Corps after service?
Well, my wife, I met her on an airplane. She was a flight attendant for Pan Am. And this was a whirlwind. We decided to get married after we'd been together 5 hours. So it was one of those. Still married after 44 years, so I guess it was okay.
Wow.
I don't recommend it to our kids, but it worked for us. And she had trained as a teacher, but she was flying because she wanted to see the world, and she did with Pan Am. And I'd come back from Vietnam, and both of us said, boy, wouldn't it be great to see the world? Yeah, and here we are, we're teachers. Yeah. And coincidentally, mm-hmm. while she was in a graduate program too, we both came home one night, living in Boston, and we'd each spoken to a recruiter who'd been on campus. I was at Tufts, and she was over at Wellesley College, part of Harvard, hooked to Harvard. And it was like a weird situation. And we both said, what about this? And right away we said, yeah, that's what we want to do. So it was a combination of being able to teach. She had an experience, and I had at least a degree and 1 year. And be able to live in another country. Living in was a critical thing, not just traveling through. And we had no obligations, we had no kids, and not real money hungry, and yeah, it sounded like the right thing to do at the time, and it certainly was.
How did your time in the Peace Corps compare to your time in Vietnam?
Yeah, in many ways, very similar. Okay? Mm-hmm. In terms of needing to understand the culture, because I kind of blew by that, but you know, working with a program as an advisor, the Navy doesn't give you much intercultural preparation for that. You're really winging it. And there were advisors that just told their counterparts what to do, and others that worked with them. So I learned about working with people who have a totally different cultural perspective on the world. In an environment that was not my home environment, right? I think they were very similar in that respect. The positives, you know, just being fascinated by. I mean, Botswana culture is not like Vietnamese culture in any way.
Right.
It is like it in that it is very different from the way we operated in Hamburg, New York. So you know, being open to that and knowing how witnessing and being a part of that kind of milieu really appealed to me and my wife. We both felt that way. We both really resonated with that. I think that, surprisingly, I think there was some similarity there. Although I don't think there are a huge number of Vietnam veterans who joined the Peace Corps right after. Kind of a nice balance.
Can you just tell me your wife's name very quickly?
Sandy Detweiler.
What was her maiden name?
Borg.
Borg. Okay. Yeah, I mean, that sounds like an incredible experience, especially after coming out of Vietnam and jumping right into another very foreign experience for an extended period of time. So were you teaching, was really day in and day out? Were you doing other things as well in Botswana?
Yeah. Well, you know, just to follow up on the first comment. Yeah, but, you know, bear in mind that I was not broken. I was not disturbed. I was not haunted by, you know, like some of the people you're talking to who were in combat. Okay. I was coming out of it. What for me was a very positive experience. Both in terms of what I was contributing, but also what I gained from it. Okay, so in fact, I think psychologically, the transition to Peace Corps was not startling. It would not have been startling to anybody if we somebody had stepped back and looked at it. So as a Peace Corps volunteer who's teaching in a local national school. I think it's true today. You're very much, you know, 24/7. You're part of that school. You know, it was the Peace Corps volunteers who did all the coaching. We were, you know, all our kids were Botswana. The headmaster of the school was in Botswana. I mean, there was one other Peace Corps volunteer, a couple Canadian volunteers, a few Danish, and a couple Brit volunteers too. In a big school, we had 700-800 kids. So,
oh wow.
So there was a Ghanaian volunteer from Ghana. I mean, you know, we get up in the morning, go teach all day, then we'd coach, and then we'd, at night we'd do lesson planning and grading, and then go back and do it the next day. And weekends we'd clean up the house, we'd get food ready. I mean, it took a little more to live there. You know, you didn't quite have all the amenities. Shopping and so forth, and then you're back at it Monday. Now, we did have holidays, and we took off. We toured South Africa. We toured what was then Rhodesia, which is now Zimbabwe. We went all over Botswana, out in the desert. I mean, we covered the territory, so we made the best of it. But fundamentally, we were teachers there.
Where in Botswana were you?
The town is Lobatse, L-O-B-A-T-S-E. Which is on the southeastern border of the country.
Do you keep in contact with any of your former students or Peace Corps friends?
No former students. A couple Peace Corps friends were at the Christmas card level, yeah.
And none of them had Vietnam War experience?
Correct.
When did you leave the Peace Corps?
77. In December of 1977, we left. We took our airplane ticket and cashed it in. This is from Botswana back to Seattle, because my wife's from Seattle, so this was a good ticket. We cashed it in, we bought a Land Rover, and we took off and drove to London for 6 months.
Oh, wow. And you just lived in London for 6 months?
No, it took us 6 months to get there.
Oh, okay.
We drove up through Botswana, over to the coast.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I misheard you. Yeah.
We stayed, you know, we camped the whole time because we didn't have much money in Serengeti, and then we came across through Rwanda and what was Zaire, and on up, and then finally crossed the desert into Algeria and worked our way over to Morocco and crossed into Gibraltar and then hightailed it to London. So,
It must have been an amazing experience. Were there any major stories that you'd like to share?
But that's another 3-hour phone call.
Okay.
Yeah, it was wonderful. You know, seeing all the different things. We climbed Mount Kilimanjaro. We were 2 weeks across the Sahara Desert, you know, where you'd see maybe one or two other cars a day. Self-sufficient. We got held up in Zaire by some drunken soldier with an automatic weapon and talked him out of it by giving him some vitamins, telling him that they helped the man perform better. And he fell for it, and he was very happy. So. I mean, there were all kinds of stories. It was just a wonderful experience. You know, I mean, there were the down times, too, getting robbed one time and other stuff. But, you know, it was great. But I injected that because, again, it's an illustration, I think, of that what was seeded with my year in Vietnam, how that did it. Open us up to not being too rattled by, you know, we don't need to stay in resorts.
And so after that long road trip, what did you do next?
Well, then we homesteaded. We settled down. We moved to Vermont. Bought an old farmhouse that had been empty for 30 years. And we both got teaching jobs, making $8,000 a year. And didn't have much money, but we put the house together. We had our kids. I went back to school at night. to look at being an administrator in schools. My wife taught. And we had three kids, a dog, the whole thing, pigs, chickens, garden. And then after 10 years, by then I was a principal in an elementary school here. And then our youngest hit kindergarten age, so you know what we did. We went back overseas. And then we spent our career then working in American international schools. Hungary, Israel, Bangladesh, Budapest, Brazil, Nepal, Austria. I was basically head of these international schools over there for 21, and then we went back for a couple of years. So that Vietnam seed again continues to grow.
Right, it really lodged itself deep.
Yeah, yeah.
And how long have you been? Were you head of these American international schools?
Yeah. Well, we went from Vermont to Greece as a principal in 1988. Okay, I did 3 years there, and then I went as head of school at the American International School in Tel Aviv for 7 years, and then in Dhaka, Bangladesh, for 3 years. In Budapest, Hungary, for 5, and in Sao Paulo, Brazil, for 3. And then I came back for a couple of years and then went to Kathmandu, set a school there for an interim, just for a semester, because they had to fire their other guy. And the next year I went to Vienna, doing the same thing for a semester.
Okay.
That's more than you wanted to hear, but that was the career.
No, that's great to hear. You mentioned earlier that in 2000 you went back to Vietnam with your wife.
Yeah.
Where did you go?
Yeah, all five of us went. The three kids. So at this time, I still remember we took $3,000 in cash with us. We were there 16 days, and that covered everything for 5 people. We went to Hanoi, then and they just took care of us. We had tour guides. Yeah. We had, but it wasn't. You didn't want to do it on your own then, and we didn't. Not with the kids.
Right.
And we went to Ha Long Bay, which is this gorgeous coastal area north of Haiphong, and then we flew to Da Nang, and then from there on, we went to these places where I had been when I was in the Navy. And we're in the north, and then we went to the center part of the coast, and then we went to Saigon, and we went down the Delta. So it was just a wonderful break, vacation for us, for the whole family. It was dirt cheap. It's not that cheap anymore. It has been discovered, especially after Obama put it on TV.
Oh, yeah. So do you keep in contact with any Dartmouth friends who might have been veterans or who went to Vietnam?
Well, the friend I mentioned, John Roll, who was a second lieutenant in the armor and up north, and he saw a lot of action. So, yeah, we see him all 3-4 times a year. He comes up. We just spent a week with him on St. John in the Caribbean this winter. And, we get together every summer, and so we're very tight with him. No other veterans. It's really just those three guys that I'm close with. And he did that. The one guy, the Rick Lounsbury, I mentioned, he got into the guard and did his 2 weeks a year here. And the third guy had a. Who was actually, he was captain of the ski team, and he was actually NCAA ski meister when we were at Dartmouth. And then he won the combine of all the. He had a bad knee, so he had a waiver. He didn't have to go in the service. Go figure. So, no, John is the only one that would fit that description.
And do you guys talk about your experiences often?
It usually comes up in but always in some humorous way.
Okay.
We did a very tasteless skit at his wedding, you know, 40 years ago, where we acted out with my wife and other women playing as bar girls, and I and this guy playing as GIs, and so it's on that level, unfortunately. Well, that tells you our maturity level when we get together. But no serious, you know, when we talk serious, we're not talking Vietnam, we're talking about Iraq or Afghanistan or Trump. Mm-hmm.
Do you talk to your wife or your kids about your Vietnam experience?
Yeah, you know, kind of like I described how my father did. I don't bring it up, and it's not a dominant fact, but in passing, you know, I might refer to that more with my wife.
Mm-hmm.
Kids certainly know what I did, both that in terms of that I've explained it to you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I wasn't in the combat side of things, and yet they know I did spend a year there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, nothing profound, nothing that worth publishing.
Okay. Yeah. So do you have any final thoughts reflecting on your experience in Vietnam, how it's impacted you today? You mentioned a couple key takeaways that you felt really stayed with you after your experience, but really looking back, is there any last thoughts that you have on your experience?
Just to underscore kind of the two domains, the one, the impact on me in terms of being, you know, opening my eyes to the world and appreciating and wanting to be see places in the world. And, you know, we've traveled a lot and lived in Australia, that's different. And then the other part is related to just some, you know, intense frustration with our foreign policy and our whole decision-making process around our military interventions, how just wasteful and dumb it is, and how we don't learn lessons. You know, and I could go on about that, but I think you get where I'm on that. You know.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I think those would be the two major things to underscore. I think you've done a good job of teasing out and being patient as I've droned on about the texture of those things.
Yeah. So if you don't have anything else to share, I think we can wrap up this interview.
Yeah.
Is that right? Great. Thank you so much, Rick. This was a really interesting conversation, and I just really want to thank you for your time. So I'll end our interview right here. It is now 2:27 p.m., May 26th, 2016, and we'll end our interview.